Everybody, I'm going to do a brief intro. We have a bunch of registrations. Not everybody is familiar with Health Rosetta, and I will provide a brief overview of kind of our five-step plan that will set the context for the questions that we'll have for Neil and Brett, who I'll introduce in a moment. And Relocalizing Health, really, you know, that's my last book, but also speaks to a lot of what we're doing. You know, health doesn't start in a pill, doesn't start in a hospital. It starts at home, mom, dad, you know, neighborhood, and fans out from there. We sometimes forget about that. 80% of health outcomes come from outside the healthcare system. And what we're all about is empowering community-owned health plans. And sometimes the best way to describe it, beyond what the words say, is to describe what it's not. You know, really the status quo, if you flip those words on their head, is disempowering Wall Street rented sick care plans. And I mentioned, this is actually what drives health outcomes. Clinical care is part of it. It's obviously important, but it's all these other things. And so we're very focused in on freeing up the money, because $90 actually are going to the medical care, and the part that's actually care, fantastic. That's appropriate. I often say healthcare is not expensive. You know, because clinicians are only getting 27 cents of every dollar ostensibly spending on healthcare. What's expensive is these other things, you know, inappropriate treatment, administrative bloat, profiteering, price gouging. And so it's pretty straightforward to get rid of those if you have the right plan in place. And so we like to talk about this five-step process. It's on the back of the Relocalizing Health book. And so what I'm going to do is go through this acrostic very quickly. Of course, there's more details and you can download the book for free. But let's just jump into those, and not everybody goes in this order. It's a good way to sort of frame the challenge. And kind of the old way of doing things is kind of plan, and then, you know, big bang, hopefully get the benefit over time. What we tend to believe is more of a step stair approach, you know, with the first step being learning how to be liberated from the status quo. The logos you see here are employers who've been doing this for 5 years, 10 years, even 20 years. And over time, as other people accept that the mythical medical trend, which doesn't exist other than for marketing purposes, the gap grows over time. And so, you know, somebody like a Rosen Hotels, which is a case study in the book and folks in my TED Talk, because they've been doing it over 20 years, they've cumulatively saved $425 million, not by really dropping costs, it just theirs didn't go up. And so the notable thing is four of these five steps are invisible or a clear positive for the member. And sometimes people are understandably concerned about changing a health plan. But really the point we like to make is, you know, the probably the most disruptive thing is actually the status quo. You know, we're the world's leader in medical bill-driven bankruptcies, and 70% of those had so-called insurance. Sometimes the upshot of that as we change is some of the burden that had been on the member is stuff that we as an employer, rather than hitting the easy button, which puts a big burden on the employee, we have to take on some of that. So we're going to go through, you know, in this webinar, some of the challenges, right? Any great thing you do comes with big challenges, and it's not all unicorns and rainbows. So we want to go through that as well. But that's really the first step. You get some benefit there. But then as we get into what do you do, the O in local is optimize plan infrastructure. The things that are on our site in the book, the plan sponsor bill of rights, the advisor code of conduct, the advisor compensation disclosure form, these are things that are kind of motherhood and apple pie. If you're new to the industry, unfortunately, they're a polar opposite. So, you know, people often ask me, what's the first thing you got to do if we're going to tackle this? We're fed up. We've said it, you know, enough. Well, hire the right benefits advisor. You can't get from here to there. There's a bit of savings you can get here, but this is really the master key that unlocks the other doors. And we'll talk about that. But even so, somebody like Copper State, they were really hardcore on this, really scrutinizing all their agreements, getting rid of junk fees, all these types of things. They saved $1,000 per employee per year. As a 1,000-plus person employer, they saved $1 million a year before even changing networks or anything. So a lot of hard work went into that, but that's the type of thing that provides some of that benefit. The first piece that gets into some of the care part is carving out PBM. Some of the greatest shenanigans in the industry happen in the PBM arena. Organizations like Caterpillar, the large employer space, really the only thing they've done was carve out PBM to an extreme degree. And they haven't seen overall healthcare spending go up because they've done such a fantastic job. I'll talk about Pacific Steel later. State of New Jersey saved $1.6 billion with a B over the first 3 years. And so you don't necessarily even have to change the formulary, which can provide savings, or change where you get, and you can get tremendous savings here. So that's the next step. And then the first thing that members might notice the carve-out PBM if cost sharing was lowered, but otherwise they wouldn't notice it. The first thing they notice, but in a good way, is add proper primary care. Kind of like the plan infrastructure, it provides some direct savings because half ER visits are not actually emergencies. So if you provide access, there's a lot of unnecessary surgeries. But if you look at the employers here, the thing that really is the underpinning of their spending, 40-50% less over a good amount of time. In the case of Roseland, like I said, it's about 25 years. I think Gasparilla, it's about 5 years. Bennett School District, we actually had a webinar earlier you can view. They're a couple years into it. These are the types of things that, because we've so badly undermined primary care in this country, it's really a shock and pleasant surprise for members when they actually get proper primary care. And then that primary care clinician can guide you through the complex stuff. So that's the next step, And then the final step, this is the one where there's real thoughtfulness, real work. There can be issues if you don't have some of the right pieces in place. And so it's one of the reasons why we don't necessarily suggest people start here unless they are really prepared for that. And that's leaving behind the value extracting PPO networks. You can, you're basically paying the privilege for wildly overpaying. Typically we see PPO networks charging at least 2.5 times Medicare rates, which is what covers costs for healthcare providers, despite what some of their lobbyists will say. Some are you're paying 10 times Medicare rates, 5 times Medicare rates. We've seen 25 times Medicare rates. It's pretty nuts. So this is where the biggest savings reside, but it's also the one you need to be the most thoughtful about. The biggest chapter in my last book is on change management, because you got to be thoughtful on this, or there can be blowback. So that's the overview. You see, there's this incremental realized benefit when you take this step-stair approach. And so that's what we advise. But let's jump into the overview with Neil Noble, who's the CEO of Calculated Risk, and Brett Brummett, who's the Health Rosetta advisor that he's been working with. And I'm going to go ahead and stop sharing. And we're going to jump into some questions, but let's just start out with a little bit of introduction. Neil, if you can provide a bit of background on your organization and what kind of organization it is, kind of your workforce and some of that, and then Brett will have you provide an introduction as well. But let's get started there. Kind of size of the plan, number of eligible employees, a little bit of the history, just kind of conversational, what's gone on there.
Sure. Thanks, Dave. Calculated Risk is sort of part of our name. We're Calculated Risk Motorcycle Group. And when you hear Calculated Risk in a healthcare related thing, folks think we're an insurer. We're the opposite. We are a group of motorcycle dealers. We own 6 Harley-Davidson dealerships in the state of Texas, and we have 2 Lucky Penny Cycle stores, which are pre-owned only used bike retailers. So we're in the retail space. Ironically, we talked about that in the prep that may occur. That's bike celebration. I apologize if we have some loud noises. We don't do subtle well here at the store. We are kind of a mid-size employer when you look at the number of folks that we have. You know, our headcounts range from 200 to kind of 400, depending upon business conditions and the season. And we have a wide range of folks from, you know, executive team on down to frontline retailers. And, you know, to kind of set up what prompted us to go down this road is it was torture really to hear team members say, hey, I can't be on the health plan. I can't afford it because it went up another 20% and the benefits went down and my co-pays went up, or we see someone who's not having health care because they couldn't afford it. And that kind of prompted us. So we have a longstanding relationship with Brett, who was key in helping us make this work. And really he's been a huge part of this for us. So that's kind of an intro to where we are right now.
Great. Brett, you want to provide any context from the advisor side of the equation?
Yeah, so this is one of those like perfect stories, right? Because the Calculated Risk team, Neil, the rest of the team have always kind of held for a long time that a self-funded plan is not where they want to go because it's not a risk they want to take on. It didn't make sense. And then, you know, several discussions over different years of, hey, how do we pull this lever, bring this down? Lots of really good discussion around, hey, the cost can't keep going up. We also can't pass it to the team member. Like, quit raising deductibles. Our team members don't have $1,000 on average. You know, don't punish them just so they can participate in the plan. You know, and we did have those instances where specialist copays got up there in the 50 and 100 range. And even that was very burdensome for the member. And so those are the things we started to address. And I actually don't know the backstory about the text that I received about 2-3 months after renewal. It says, what do you know about self-funding? But I got one of those and that kicked off a more robust situation about how to change the course.
Yeah, great. Yeah, I mean, the member hit is significant. I mean, I think a lot of people, you know, that's been the so-called solution by the status quo rather than actually address the core problems of price gouging and profiteering. And they've just pushed it onto the back of the American worker. I mean, you have about half the workforce where their out-of-pocket deductibles are greater than their life savings. To me, I call that functionally uninsured. You know, when you're a bad stub toe away from financial ruin. And I think that's what's great to hear about, you know, organizations like Calculated Risk saying, okay, like we do really care about our people and man, we're spending a lot of money ourselves. There's gotta be a better way. So there are any other parts of kind of the, to kind of, I guess, get people on board, you know, on either side of the equation for you, or was it really a decision, Neil, you made and then pushed through?
Well, it really did start with the idea. And, you know, Brett was very proactive on suggesting early on, hey, we may need to go to some sort of self-funded or partially self-funded plan. And we pushed back aggressively. I think it was Adam that said to you, who's our president, he said, look, I don't want to be in the insurance business. We're in the motorcycle business. We take plenty of risk, you know, owning and operating these stores. The last thing we want to do is be a health insurer. You know, we don't want the extra burden. We don't want the extra exposure. That's just not what we want to do. And I think that first meeting, Brett, you know, the pushback was, it wasn't a discussion as much as it was just a really hard no. And we sort of sent you on your way and said, hey, we're going to look at these other options to renew. And it was probably a year or it was either the next year or the following year that we sent you the unprompted text of what do you know about self-funded plans? Because what we were seeing is our contribution as an employer was increasing. Our pricing that the team members were paying on a monthly basis was increasing, and it was increasing dramatically. You know, both of us were seeing 20, 30, 40% increases in the monthly expenditure, and the deductibles were climbing faster than the expenditure. So we have folks that are paying, the bulk of our team are single folks. And you know, for those people, especially some of them that are new in a fairly entry-level retail position, they're happy to have coverage, But then whenever something comes up, they can't use it. You know, like you said, Dave, they look at the deductible and they make the choice to say, I'm just going to grin and bear it and sort of, you know, rub some dirt on it and suffer through with this and hope it gets better, because I can't afford to go spend the money to get it looked at by the specialist. And then if I need surgery or I need a procedure, there's another copay there. And as it starts to add up, they see that it's financial ruin if they go fix whatever the problem is. And we were seeing a lot of that occur.
Yeah.
And it was hard at renewal time to stand in front of the team and say, hey, great news. We've fought and negotiated really hard for 2 months and we've got a renewal on health insurance where you're going to be paying 25% more. You know, your deductible went up another $500 for you and $1,000 for your family, and all of the copays and all the visits went up as well. It just, it hurt to say that to the team. And that's when we sent the text to Brett that said, hey, let's talk about these other plans.
Yeah. Great news. You got to pay more and get less. What a deal. I'm sure that your customers would love that if you did that with your retail operation. Yeah. I mean, probably the chapter out of the book that resonates more with leadership than the other is, you're in the healthcare business, whether you like it or not. You know, here's how to, you know, that's the way it is in our country, especially if you're a decent sized organization. But you know, the sort of accompanying thing is, you're also self-insured whether you like it or not, because the reality is, if you have a bad claim, the carriers are going to claw back that money, and so you're already really carrying that risk, and that's sometimes tough to swallow, but it is one of those things that we got to deal with, and so you're already working with Brett, you know, as a health reset advisor. You know, one of the core tenets is aligned interest and disclosure. And so that's great that you've got that piece in place. So we won't go through that so much since you were already working with Brett. And like a lot of health reset advisors, you know, they have clients all kind of through the stages of the journey. Ones who've been on self-funded and like hit all those boxes for years. Others that they're still, you know, going through education on what are the trade-offs, how do we manage this, and all that. And so, Brett, did you have a basically work with just the carrier-based self-funded platform, or did you have some independent folks? We don't have to go through the vendors because we don't have time for that. That's a different discussion. But just in terms of, did you work with kind of the carrier provided chassis, or did you work with independent folks?
In this situation, we didn't work with any of the carrier provided ones. We had looked at carrier provided, you know, arrangements alongside fully insured for the past 2 or 3 years, kind of as a due diligence step for the most part. That was where I would, you know, kind of push the different controllers and the financial people on aspects and be like, no. And then when it went this way, we actually went through a kind of tolerance exercise with the team of what they wanted. And I think the discussion kind of ended, rip the Band-Aid, do it all, go fast and get us there. And so we did the independent route with the vendors and did most of the items of the local area all at day one, and then have been trying to improve upon those as we keep going through each iteration, whether that's yearly or monthly or crisis by crisis.
Yep, great. How about on the drug front, the, you know, carve out, the C is carve out PBM. What's there been any impact on members, you know, when you took a different route? How does that, the drug plan?
So for me, I think I went from probably one of my most hated PBMs that the group had as part of their package to one that had really good customer service and you actually didn't mind talking to them. I did lots of warm, you know, handoffs from a team member to the PBM service center to the pharmacy. And then I even had the PBM call me back and tell me the resolution that it was done within like 2 hours and they had to stay on with the team member. And so just the touch and feel of that piece of it was probably one of the shining stars. Now, as far as cost, we were able to do a lot of the, you know, pass through things and discounts right back to the membership. And there's a couple of members we were able to utilize their specialty drugs to get them down to a, you know, if you will source it here, you won't have your $500 copay. And so that was a big relief for a couple.
Yeah, that can be a game changer. And I think I recall seeing some story about somebody who has diabetes and there were cost issues there. Can you share anything about that without, you know, violating HIPAA?
Yeah, so that one was one of our store locations where during the initial rollout, you know, the 2-3-4 week education campaign and roadshow, where we had one that, you know, he had griped at me years before about, you know, the cost and why is it going up and why is this going up? And then when we got this round, we actually got, okay, so I can get the drug, I haven't seen my doctor forever. I haven't been taking my medications for quite a while. Like I'm a non-compliant diabetic because I can't get to the doctor during work hours. And they're too far away and I need my refill, but it's too expensive. So I just kind of get in that spiral of, you know, not a self-pity spiral, but it's a healthcare journey spiral. It's the thing that keeps you from getting care because there's so many barriers. And so we actually got him in with a virtual provider. I think that day or the next day later, got a visit done before the plan actually started, because that was going to be a bundled care piece. Got that done and then got him back on a diabetic maintenance program. I think we even did the at-home delivery. So we went from a non-compliant member to one that was getting care and getting home delivery just for convenience for him and no expense on either item for him.
Are you aware, has that helped improve his health as far as you know?
I personally don't know.
Yeah. I imagine. Assumptions are my best. The thing that's kind of amazing with the diabetes medications is, you know, the insulin was basically discovered at the University of Toronto in Canada, and they sold the patent for $1 to one of the pharma companies. I don't think they charge a little more over a little more than $1. And the other thing that's kind of amazing to people is not to let, you know, pharma off the hook, but there's not one pure pharma company in the Fortune 50. The only one that's in is J&J, and they've got a bunch of different businesses. And yet the big three PBMs, where their primary or most profitable business is the PBM side, are all Fortune 50 companies. And, you know, one of them that you know is the brand is a big retailer, and they tend to think of them as a big retail brand, but $120 billion out of the $185 billion that they earn is their PBM business. So it gives you an idea of how effective. I mean, they put to shame Wall Street arbitragers in terms of the games that are played. So good on you guys for moving on from that. And a good segue you touched on, which gets into the add value-based primary care, is you talked about a virtual primary care organization. You know, as Neil mentioned, they have several locations. Can you talk a little bit about what's going on and what you've done on the primary care front and what that has done?
You know, that's probably one of the biggest heartaches we actually went through year one and probably still work through is not so much the cost of the primary care at this point, but the unfamiliarity of not having the network logo at the point of service. And so that's really where we've worked over the past, you know, year and a half to keep improving upon that. We really kind of had to go into it blindly, not knowing, just going from a traditional network model to a non-network model. That worked fine. We actually had a little bit of the cliff from a sales presentation from one of our vendors to the drop off to real life. And that was kind of a steep drop we hit that time. And so there was a lot of work of, you know, extra phone calls on our part, working with the vendors, making sure they got paid, not vendors, providers, clinicians in their front office. But we've gone and worked with other, you know, independent, non-hospital based owned practices now to build in some direct contracts. And so we've got, and this is kind of a, like an almost unfortunate, like the team members in the Metroplex area have a lot better access than some of the more rural areas as we've grown, just because we have to solve for the biggest need first. So we have in the Metroplex area close to about 250, 300 primary care providers that are now under a direct contract. And some of those are in the outskirts too, but as we keep going, we've done that. Now we're moving into, trying to do things for the pediatric level so that we don't have that issue, which is a huge dissatisfier when everything goes well for the parent, but when the kids got to go to care, they get turned away. And that's the kiss of death for plan satisfaction.
Oh yeah. Given last year with COVID and so many practices adding telehealth, in that scenario of any of those kind of maybe once traditional practices, are they like, I remember there's a DPC organization in Tyler, Texas, in East Texas, and they have some clients who are truckers. And now they come back to the home base sometimes, but they ended up adding kind of telehealth. Has that been considered of some of those, like where you don't yet have it, and I don't know how many hundreds of miles away people are, but like, has that been looked at all as far as, I mean, of course the virtual primary care, but any of the more bricks and mortar now that they've added telehealth, is that a consideration at all for either pediatrics or, adult primary care?
Neil, I may let you jump in on part of this, but this is something that we've actually been doing even under the fully insured model, we used to provide a bolt-on unlimited free access to the member and family telemedicine program. And so we kind of ratcheted that up from the triage care to more of the virtual primary care over the past couple of years. And I think that some people really like the convenience of the quick and easy free one, and some just don't. But we saw a huge uptick in it, even in the fully insured days. And then we went from our first self-insured, there was probably a really large move of adaptation. Though COVID, I don't know that I got a real good sense, but that I did start doing other like educational pieces, like don't forget you have it, and how do you reach a team member when they're not there? And we kind of, hacked some more like team member communication through text programs in place for reminders.
Yeah, that makes sense. Neil, anything you'd add on that?
Yeah, just to add quickly, on the telehealth and some of those other technological healthcare items, our team, we're not the most dynamic technology driven population, but what's happened is once one team member uses it and has a really good outcome, they share the story. So it really, Brett's done a good job and our team has done a good job of driving the information out, but it hasn't been as impactful as the first time that someone at a location, they've got a sore, terrible throat and they call and they get a hold of the doctor and they're able to go through things and diagnose that, hey, it is strep throat or it's not, or whatever it is, and they're able to get the prescription they need, get it filled and get healthy. But then they share that with someone else and go, hey, if you're not feeling well, here's an option. You can get this solved, and it works really well. So for us, that word of mouth has been the driver of implementation more so than, Brett and Shane, one of our guys, and one of the reps from the TPA that we were with initially did a huge roadshow. And I think that was helpful, but what really drove the adoption, and it was the same thing here with the technology, is as soon as someone used it, the spread.
Yeah, for sure. That makes sense. Kind of the final L, or the second L in local is, leave behind value extracting PPO networks. So maybe just as a segue into that, if you could just touch on a little bit, what was the trend in terms of premium increases and, burden being put on the backs of employees, and then kind of what's happened since the change? Maybe if either one you can take that, if you could summarize that would be appreciated.
Brett, you want to take this one?
Sure. I mean, that was the, you've outlined it a few times in your different books, but, the annual dance of the 16 or 20% renewal to what can you give me as a rate concession? How do we move a deductible here? How do we move a copay here? How do we, lop off out of network claims for a network plan? It was just the annual fight of how to do everything. And then, kind of the me going back and, facing Neil and, sweating for a few days. By the way, Neil's like 6'5". I'm like 5'5". So that it was an interesting dance of doing that. Then, you know, like we talked about, the team member experience, and then having to deliver a message of don't really look at where your health plan is going up to. We've got to, you know, we've now upped your annual ability to go to the dentist to 4 times. Like, don't look over here.
Yeah.
The jumps were getting to be really large. You know, whenever it was a win for us to be able to get the renewal from being a 22% or a 23% increase, you know, of course, over a double-digit increase from the prior year, it was a win if we got it down to a 13 or 14% increase. The, hey, you know, Brett and I could high-five afterwards. Boy, we really knocked this down. I mean, yeah, the deductibles went up and the coverages went down and the network got smaller, but look what we did. So that was one of the biggest drivers that prompted the sort of, you know, random middle of the week text that said, Brett, what do you know about self-funded plans?
Yeah, makes sense. I'd say probably the most shocking chapter in my book that people read is one that says basically, you know, in the real market, costs are flat in healthcare. Doesn't mean prices are flat. The one exception is specialty drugs. But, you know, I go through, because actually there's what I call the real market. Is the direct contracts, which Brett mentioned, and the cash pay market, which are actually quite large in this era of high deductibles. And so we have data on how really over the last 5 to 10 years in the real market, prices are unchanged because the underlying costs haven't changed. Doctors and nurses aren't paid fundamentally differently than they were 10, 20 years ago. And now to extract that, you know, sort of unwind that is work. There's no doubt. You got to be thoughtful about that process. But that's kind of the sort of the golden ring, because that's where the big dollars are, you know, is with the hospitals and you know, all that. So, you know, it's great that you've gone through that journey. So we're going to segue into questions in a moment. I see a number have come in. But before that, you know, just start me thinking about some of your questions. What I'm going to do is provide a quick overview of the employer program that we recently launched. And what we did, which sort of like the advisor program that Brett's a part of, which is around education and sort of level the playing field. We are just in the process of launching an employer program for folks who want to join that. So I'm gonna just provide a very brief overview. Basically, it's all about educating, inspiring peer groups. There's employer roundtables. We have education sessions, kind of like what we do for advisors on particular components. We have adoption plans, a bunch of resources. And we also do something we call an opportunity summary, which is kind of a high level, think of like a second opinion on your health plan. And so that is really just to be a resource for folks who want to become a more educated purchaser. Typically it's decision makers. We have school superintendents, CFOs, we've got HR people, you know, typically that's a best fit for organizations in the kind of 50 to 5,000 arena in terms of number of employees. It's $99 a month, no long-term contracts. You could sign up for 3 months or whatever and drop it. But if you're interested, you can go to healthrosetta.org/employers. And so that's kind of the quick overview. Now let's segue into the Q&A. Let me pull that up. And so the first question is actually, speaking of the employer program, somebody who is in the employer program, Annie Foley, asked, from HR side, the pushback I've received is regarding the amount of administrative work for self-funded plans. How do you respond to that? I mean, I imagine, Brett, that's something that you probably deal with on, you know, pretty much a daily basis.
You know, from my perspective, Neil, we kind of buffer a lot of that for the calculators team when we can, just trying to get it set up as streamlined as possible. So really between the technology pieces we have in place and the TPA services, aside from having, you know, five transactions a month instead of one, it's really not a different burden from that aspect of it because everything's been streamlined. So I wouldn't see that part of it being the stumbling block, though if you haven't done it, it does look overwhelming.
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, the other thing that certainly Neil's aware of this, I think anybody in leadership is aware of this, but sometimes it can be kind of jarring to realize that for a lot of organizations, their health benefits is their second or third biggest cost, typically payroll. And, you know, if they've got hard goods, it might be the third biggest cost. And if you look at an organization like, I forgot to get into detail with Pacific Steel when I was going through the examples, they're about a 700 plus person organization, manufacturer and recycler based out of Montana, employees in 9 states, 40 locations. You know, a handful of years ago, they were spending over $8 million. They're now spending, last I heard, under $3.5 million. So that's basically $4.5-5 million that went to the bottom line for a low margin, mature industry. I was just kind of doing, they're a private organization, but I was just kind of doing a little math in my head. And I asked the CFO, now retired CFO, that had overseen that. I said, I'm guessing you would have to have a 20% increase in top line sales revenue to have that same impact on your profit. He's like, nah, actually more like 25 to 30%. So there can be some real benefit as you get deeper into this and start to get that cumulative effect. So that's something worth mentioning. So there's kind of a follow-up question.
Before we go on to that next one, yeah. I have to add something from the employer side. You know, the HR piece of it, you do have to be prepared. You know, I use an analogy with our team when we're managing change is that, you know, whether you're out at calm seas or you're on the beach, either of those is pretty stable. But to get from one to the other, you've got to go surf. You're going to get beat up pretty good. And the initial transition that we made, our controllers, which handle most of our HR role, our general managers, our department managers, Brett's cell phone, all saw a huge, you know, ramp up in questions and problems and confusion and issues. So if you do make this sort of change, the first, you know, 90 days in particular, if kind of first quarter or two, as folks start to go out and experience healthcare, there's confusion. And the other piece that I think is really important, and we did a decent job with, but we could have done a better job, was incorporating the spouses with the rollout. Because what would happen is we would have the team member, you know, husband, wife, whatever, whichever one works for us at the store, getting a call from an angry, you know, spouse, hey, I'm at the doctor, they're not covering this, what do I do? So in the initial rollout, there is a lot of HR pressure for whoever it is that handles benefits and deals with your team. There's gonna be confusion, there's gonna be questions. So having a really good, really good resource like we have with Brett and just over communicating is really important. But once we got through that first, Brett, would you say that was maybe a 4 to 6 month window where it was pretty rocky and then everything kind of started to calm down and now it's reasonably calm and steady. But the first part of the switch is challenging because it's so different.
Yeah, I'd say the first, you know, no one understands healthcare until they have to encounter it. So any kind of change through open enrollment is not the end. It's the launch point. It's the pre-party for the emails, the phone calls, the anger. And you kind of have to prepare not only for me, I prepare myself and my team that everyone that's having that, every moment's a crisis and it's not their best day. Like if they're calling me, it is not their best day. Like, so you can't take the person and judge them by the situation. And so you just kind of have to be really compassionate. And that's really honestly where the good vendors, the good PBMs, the good TPAs come alongside and can really take that member through the journey to kind of ease that burden. And that's something also very difficult to figure out who those are before you go into it. We've swapped out through that aspect of it. And so being able to figure out, you know, if there's fire behind the smoke or if a trend line is going up or going down and when it recovers, I think that's been a big piece of the Health Rosetta advisor community, to go outside just this specific thing and gather the feedback and figure out what's really going on.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, it's one of the things that we're pleased with putting together this program is, you know, we don't have the answers, right? The community has the answers, and there's very few situations that haven't been seen before. In fact, I mentioned Pacific Steel, they have enough of people and they've saved enough that they now have kind of a concierge member navigator type person that's actually they brought in-house. I've seen other organizations, particularly when it's a small organization, where the advisor has kind of a care navigator. Sometimes they're a nurse, sometimes they're somebody who's been in the healthcare system a lot, and maybe their child had been sick or something like that. So those types of things can make that scary situation, because it's kind of, you know, to pick up on what Neil said, this is both navigating the benefits and navigating the system. Is the analogy that I've used and sort of personally experienced from my dad's 5-year Parkinson's journey is, you know, when the seas are calm, you know, even after you get through that surf, it's, you know, relatively straightforward. The medical seas get choppy. Like you said, I mean, this is not people's best day. And you want that seasoned sea captain to help navigate the plan, but then also that's when you got great primary care. They can be that seasoned sea captain. I mean, in our case, you know, through my dad's journey, they had great primary care. Lots of stuff happens over that time, as you might imagine with Parkinson's. Yet, because he had such great primary care, he didn't spend a day in the hospital. It was way better for him, way better for my mom and myself and my siblings, and, you know, probably saved the taxpayers when it's all said and done, somewhere between $250,000, knowing how things can go sideways. You know, that's an elderly population, but those types of things can happen. You know, you got a complex cancer, you know, these types of things do happen. Let's see, a couple other questions. One thing that was somebody asked about the claims administrators. They work with an independent TPA. We're really because these webinars are evergreen. We don't tend to talk about specific vendors because a lot of vendors have a shelf life, right? They will be great, and then they will run into problems. The important thing is to have a plan where it's, if you need to swap out, you can. And so if you're in the program, we have resources. We go through a deep vetting process and we continue to monitor, and there can be issues. And so it's a very fair process that we put vendors through, but frankly, it's a very onerous process where we require them to have dedicated teams to supporting these types of plans for the very issue Brett mentioned. These are different. You need to have people who are very experienced in how you navigate that. They have standardized deal terms. They have standardized data sharing agreements. They have standardized service level and implementation plans. This is what allows these things to become more plug and play. And so, the nice thing is the good TPAs are responsive. And if they're not, then it's time to swap them out. So there's there was a comment that Annie Foley had following up the earlier question, which is worth mentioning. She's like, I feel like the people push back on the admin side are speaking from years old experience. Now there's tech that can help a lot with the administrative side, and that's true. And so it's not as burdensome as it's been. Scott Haas is on the webinar as well. He chimed in with, he was the advisor who worked with Pacific Steel, that it's really a core part of their team now is the kind of member navigator, internal advocate. The next question is around, we just begun our foray, Alan Devereaux, asks into direct contracting and bundle case pricing. Do you have any advice for the companies just wading in to try and to change the supply side of the equation instead of the demand side that said deductibles and wellness programs are what you should focus in on? I have a few thoughts there, but Brett, are there any, you know, it sound like you have some direct contracts. Do you have any particular thoughts there that you would mention?
I think mine is that I'm very hesitant to go think that we can get some of those things done. And through the course of the, you know, the last year or so, pre-renewal to kind of getting it done this year, I mean, it's not as bad as I had feared. Now, there's always the, hey, did you get that really read really well? And did you work with a template? Is it reviewed? And who's signing? And all the logistics of it. And it is a, it's a process you probably don't want to go through alone. And so I was actually able to piggyback on a couple of the ones that actually utilize Sean at Health Rosetta to help through the process.
Yeah, that is something that we have gotten very, very involved in. I've learned a lot from people like Scott Haas. I mean, in the case of Pacific Steel, in a couple years, 2-3 years, they had 5,000 direct contracts in place. And the only way you do that, they're not the size of Walmart or anything, is that they're very fair, simple contracts. These are 2-page agreements. And the vast majority of healthcare spending isn't emergent. And so if you can get out ahead of the care, like when you have the member advocate, then you can go, hey, you know, Sam's gonna come in, he needs a rotator cuff procedure. We'd like to use your facility. You know, we'd like to do it under these terms. And there are pain points on the provider organization side that we can remove. You know, they, with all these high deductibles, they have terrible accounts receivable problems. It's brutal for them to get paid by the carriers and to wait around. So if you can have something where you waive cost sharing for the member, you pay promptly, they will give you a very, very fair deal, and they will be as good or better off than they were before. And there's some third-party organizations that are very involved in that. We're not doing all that ourselves, but because we have 5 million lives already in our community that are stewarded through Health Rosetta Advisors, even if it's a, you know, we've had 100 person employers where we can get deals that, you know, are like Walmart or something like that, because they, A, like working directly with employers, B, we represent a bigger opportunity. You know, one that we've done a lot of work with, they're based in the DC area, but they actually have a lot of, they have an employee hub in Texas. So there's potentially, the way these agreements work is we call them open aggregator agreements. So somebody like Brett can benefit from that and vice versa. And it's kind of, you're kind of meshing together, you know, access to care. The next question is from Greg Carroll. To the big carriers are touting their integration capabilities, medical plus PBM, and how this solution will help drive down costs for large self-insured clients. Would like to hear your perspective on this. I definitely have a perspective on this. You know, I mentioned earlier that the organization that you know, had $185 billion in revenue, big retailer / PBM, they're so big they could acquire a mega carrier. One of the reasons they do that is the medical loss ratio, which is kind of a wonky thing that's in the Affordable Care Act, that you got to spend, you know, 80 or 85 cents of every dollar on medical care, doesn't apply to drugs. And so they can profiteer like gonzo. And so you'll hear things like, we will provide you free admin. Look at their financials. They, of course, can bury the admin costs, which are trivial compared to the profiteering opportunity in the PBM. And so, you know, there are, I will say that, there's, in fact, Scott Haas has some experience with this. One of the big three PBMs, if you know how to structure the agreement properly, you can actually get a good price from them, but of course they're not going to give that without asking. And so be very wary of free anything, and also be very wary of so-called, we saved you money. Like they will say, you know, oh, premiums were going to go up 20%. And now they're only going up 10% and they call that savings. Like that's not actual savings in the real world. Savings is actually a, you know, actual drop in cost. So that's what we're talking about. So anyway, there's definitely the great news, if you want to call it that, is there's so many games going on there. We've seen up to, I think, 32 different revenue streams PBMs have created for themselves that if you actually work with ethical organizations, structure the agreements right, you can save tremendous sums of money. And, you know, one of this isn't this particular organization, but in a prior webinar with a Schrier company, Team Schrill, I think was what they go by, you know, they, one of their businesses, they own convenience stores. There was a $12 an hour cashier that she has some expensive medication. It was like $300 a month in copays. And once they started procuring drugs in a smart way, they were able to waive those costs. What that meant for her was for the first time she'd been married and had kids, they were able to take their family on a vacation. They'd never been able to do that before. So that's the kind of human impact we're talking about. So it's not, again, what I call disruption is the status quo, not moving off of that. Let's see, George Klassen, who's a Health Rosetta advisor, he had a good comment. He said, on the HR pushback on more work, if the business is saving a couple hundred thousand dollars, they should see the sense of investing in their HR department to get the help or contract. Like I said, I know a number of advisors that kind of fractionalize the member navigator, you know, across multiple clients. So that's something that some folks are doing. So that's something to be aware of. And then Gerald O'Keefe asks, how are the primary care direct contracts structured? Is it with traditional fee-for-service primary care practices or with more, you know, kind of subscription-based DPC practices? And also the follow-on is reference-based pricing being utilized for other care? So that's probably a good question for Brett.
Yeah, so our, you know, your traditional adult primary care, those are, you know, reference-based fee-for-service, you know, Medicare percentage contracts. Some of the things in pediatric care aren't always covered in there. And so those end up being either a cost or a cost plus model of the direct contract. And others are just utilizing their cash rates, like having that provider that has a good cash rates agreement that when we've run it past the team and said, no, that's marginally the same end results, we've done that way. We have looked at different DPC providers. We don't have a huge, you know, population in any one location. So it's very hard to justify some of those expenses across the board when you're looking at having a kind of the same, like you're still having to pick a new provider and it's not the new provider and the message isn't consistent and one team member's experience won't be the same with the other one. We just haven't gone down that route. We've looked at it some, but a lot of them get there and then they want to pitch you to, you know, their virtual capabilities, and the virtual capabilities at 2 to 2.5 times what our traditional virtual ones are doing. It just hasn't made the sense versus working with the local practices that are still in the fee-for-service model to get the good care, especially with one of them that is a kind of trending to a really good shareable, accountable practice model in the way they work it.
Yeah, great. The last question before we're out of time is in the drug area. So the question is around what about technology companies like GoodRx? I know they work with different PBMs. You know, is that a good alternative for small employers? My opinion is, you know, it can be a starting point. They definitely can make things suck less than the status quo. But if you actually have the right program in place, you know, that L4Z Advisor can put in place, that stuff generally becomes unnecessary. So that would be my set. And then I saw Scott Haas jumped in with a comment, so I'll add it here since we're on the drug thing. He says, who cares if the clinical programs within the integrated PBM solution save $1.75 PMPM when there's a $19 PMPM overcharge and spread price and rebate retention? And so, you know, definitely that is true. And if you look at a lot of the plans, they just keep throwing little band-aids or distractions on top of, you know, a giant hairball. That's a lot of what we do is do a reset. Actually, healthcare isn't that complicated. I mean, you need to have risk management for the high claims. You need to have proper primary care, drug coverage, access to specialists and surgery. Like, it's not that much more complicated than that. And rather than just trying to lipstick pigs and pave cow paths, let's just fix it. And that's what we're really about. So any final words that you want to share, Neil or Brett, before we wrap up? Again, thanks so much for taking your time. I hope there were some more horns that went off while you were on mute. Sales continue to go well as we get into good motorcycle season, I'm sure, there in Texas. So any final thoughts you want to share before we wrap up?
Well, thanks for letting us participate. You know, this has been an interesting journey. The only piece we missed today that I think is really worth sharing, and I believe this is coupled with the TPA. Brett will fix it if I'm wrong, but there's a marketplace feature that we have that when we have a team member that needs a procedure, it's not something emergent, right? It's, hey, I've got an injury, but I need to have an ankle surgery or whatever that may be. We've had great experience where they're able to work with that marketplace who shops for providers who save us money as a company, as the plan, and saves enough to be able to waive all or most of the copay or deductible for the team member. We've actually had a few folks have procedures done that they were putting off because they couldn't afford the copay. And, you know, by getting it done, they're getting a better outcome, and now they can actually perform better at work and just be healthier and happier as human beings. And the savings was enough that they weren't paying that huge out of pocket. So that's a piece that I think, you know, you can look at it from the plan savings standpoint, but really the experience that our team has, and that drives a lot in terms of productivity, health, and performance for us. So that was kind of missed, and just wanted to make sure we shared that.
That's a great addition. Thanks for jumping in on that. Brett, any final thoughts?
You know, just that this is a different program than your traditional plans, and what you're tackling are much more impactful problems than finding out why someone doesn't have an ID card and finding out that you're just going to get told no, or it is the way it is. Like, the ability to unlock the conversations to actually get something done is really refreshing. And so while it is seen as somewhat more of a burden at times, the end result is so much different than just a simple blank yes or no, or management says no, or it can't be done. It's a, how do we get it done? So we work to a yes.
Yeah. That's great. Well, thanks again. Thanks for everybody for joining us. Great questions. You'll receive a follow-up email with a download. Again, you can go to Health Rosetta, download our books for free. And there's links to purchase if you want. We, again, share the employer program, healthrosetta.org/employers or employer. So have a great rest of your day and great weekend. And thanks again to Neil and Brett for joining us. And we're going to sign off. Thank you.